Thank you. My name is Raja Rangaswamy, and I'm going to talk about a project that we started about a year and a half ago called Software Persistent Memory. And the reason I wanted to talk about that project is I see it as really relevant to smart infrastructure. This talk is going to be a little different than the previous two. It's going to be a little or perhaps a lot more technical, and I apologize for that. I hope some of you find what you're doing interesting. So I'll start by listing out some of the requirements that we see from a software and systems building standpoint as challenges or requirements. I don't want to go over the domains, which Colin actually went over really well, but there are a whole bunch of different domains that demand or would benefit from smart infrastructures. And some of the common aspects from a software standpoint, especially the computing layer that Colin put up in his slide, where data is ingested and some intelligent decisions are put forward that affect change in these infrastructures, relate to self-management. And we observe that self-management is often and typically is based on some sort of intelligence that is mined using the abundance of data that's collected from a variety of different sources. The other observation that we make to connect what we are doing in the Software Persistent Memory project with smart infrastructures is that intelligence demands memory. Memory in terms of keeping track of what happened in the past, what is the current state of the system, and based on such memory, smart decisions can possibly be made. Finally, we also observe that fault-tolerant intelligence demands persistent memory. So the memory that cannot be lost, because the system must tolerate failures from a variety of different sources. It could be software crashes, it could be power failures, it could be hardware crashes. So all of these kinds of events that are unexpected and must be dealt with in a fault-tolerant solution. And I'm arguing that building self-managing, intelligent software systems for managing smart infrastructures fundamentally requires this capability of persistent memory. The other side of it is the simulation world, and we can think of large-scale simulations for running all of the complex models related to smart infrastructure to understand and argue about what are scenarios and do many kinds of analysis via simulation. They are useful, perhaps not always, but sometimes they are useful. And large-scale simulations tend to be massively parallel. They use a lot of computing resources, and they also tend to be long-running, because if you want to analyze something that is substantial and forward-looking and detailed, then it is necessarily a long-running simulation process. And such simulation software also require fault tolerance, because you run simulation on hardware and software that and power that could be unreliable. And once again, we argue that there is a need for persistent memory when you simulate smart infrastructures. Yes. Right. Well, one form of persistent memory is certainly in file system and disk-based storage. As I'll illustrate in just a bit, we are looking at a very different kind of computing model, where when you build applications look at memory as traditionally volatile memory as being persistent. That simplifies a lot of different things when you write simulations or you write software that's self-managing. So I'll give you an example in just a bit which might make this more clear. So the problem is, like I said, software, system, or power failure, and one of the solutions that is obvious is to just do the whole thing all over again, re-execution, which can be time-consuming and expensive, an alternate solution is to recover from some sort of a state that's made persistent, and so that the software can proceed from the point of failure or slightly before the point of failure. So checkpoints, as illustrated in this figure, are better than re-execution because the amount of time to recovery is less. Now, we are arguing that these checkpoint solutions still incur substantial overhead. And we base this argument on program characteristics, and this program could be self-managing software, it could be simulations, and in fact there are many other domains where such program characteristics are found repeatedly, and our solution would apply to those as well. Now, one thing which we observe is that programs modify only a subset of the data that they typically hold in memory. So if you look at two checkpoints, the changes from checkpoint 1 to checkpoint 2 can actually be small compared to the size of the memory state that the program is working with. In fact, the problem is even more interesting because the amount of data that's really required for recovery is a subset of those changes that are observed in memory state from checkpoint 1 to checkpoint 2. Right. So now, how do programs identify that absolute bare minimum set of data that needs to be persistent across two checkpoints? What is being done today is either complete recording of all the changes, which means changes apart from the changes that are absolutely required for recovery, and alternatively, there are programs that can manually track changes, which becomes extremely cumbersome and inefficient, as I'll illustrate in this next example. So the developer of any such software system would then need to know all data that needs to be persistent, which is cumbersome, keep track of all the changes to data that needs to be persistent. If you visualize a balanced binary tree example, starting from the initial tree and insertion of a node into the tree, before balancing, the tree looks like this. So that change is perhaps easy to track because it's a change to one node. There is an additional node that's added, and then the hierarchy just got changed minimally. But after the balancing operation, the hierarchy changes substantially. And keeping track of all those changes becomes hard for the developer. So keeping track of such complex dependencies, which are in turn dependent on the logic of the program itself and the logic of the software, we are arguing is cumbersome. The other complementary requirement is that once you know the data in memory that needs to be persistent, the developer also needs to serialize such data so that it can be written out to a serial storage system, say a file system. And serialization of arbitrary data structures, we are arguing, is also cumbersome. So this is the sort of the current state of fault-tolerant software based on persistent memory, which I'm arguing requires some changes. So our solution to this problem is what we call software persistent memory, which I'll refer to as SoftPM moving forward, where applications get to allocate and interact with persistent memory in pretty much the same way that they work with volatile memory. Now, let me tell you a little bit more about that. In this kind of a paradigm, the developer would then specify the top-level data structures to persist. So let's say that this fault-tolerant software uses a tree, and perhaps each node of the tree is a linked list. All the developer would need to do is specify the root of that tree as being persistent, and our solution would automatically derive all the dependencies and make the entire structure persistent. So you can see how this fundamentally changes the view of the developer in writing fault-tolerant software. And then the other thing that the developer would need to specify is when to create checkpoints. And I think this is interesting and important to analyze. We think that if the developer would know at which point in the state of the execution of the program, the data in memory is sufficiently consistent that it can be written out to storage. On the other hand, if we made decisions independently within our solution, we could be writing out data that's inconsistent. So we ask that the developer specify when to create checkpoints, which is a simple operation. And then finally, and perhaps the more difficult part for the developer is to recreate the execution from the recovered persistent memory. And this is something that is application dependent. It's based on the logic within the program that we do not address yet. But this is something that we are trying to address now, this limitation, with a complementary solution which deals with making program state itself persistent. But that's not something that I'm going to talk about today. Now, our goals when we started off with this project is to ensure that our solution will require minimal source code changes or additions on part of the developer to use our solution. And then our solution, like I said, would automatically detect all the data to be checkpointed, track all the changes to data that's being modified to the persistent data, as well as address the performance issue of minimizing the checkpoint creation and restoration time. Yes?
So if you make the data change in the last checkpoint persistent, you also run the risk that the data itself could be corrupted due to a programming bug or hardware error. So do you have any solution to deal with that? Like, should the developer manually check the correctness of the data before writing it?
That's a great question, and we did think about that. Let me see. I'll address that question in just a couple of slides.
I have another question. I mean, if you would take the state of a clock, by the time you checkpoint it, we started, the clock has moved. We're on. So any real-time data is invalidated by the passage of time between taking the checkpoint and restoring the checkpoint. So going back to the old checkpoint in the real-time system really doesn't make sense.
I'm not arguing that all kinds of systems will be able to use such a solution, but to answer your specific question about time, the checkpointing operation in our system is an atomic operation.
It happens at an instant in real time.
It happens at an instant in real time, exactly.
But the recovery operation happens at another instant in real time.
Right.
And the result has changed between the two instants.
That's absolutely true. And if the system cannot deal with recovery and change of time, then we cannot solve that problem. Certainly not.
Well, you need other solutions.
You need other solutions, absolutely. So, to tell you a little bit about the basic approach that we're pursuing here, what we're implementing in some sense is application-directed checkpointing, but with the caveat that applications interact with our solution in a very minimal way. And just to inform the bare essential pieces of information that is required to make memory persistent and the memory that the application wants to be persistent. The data to be checkpointed is discovered automatically, and I'll tell you a little bit more about that. It's probably a lot more about it. And then our approach is to create checkpoints fast and recover fast. And this is something that's extremely important, because if you can checkpoint faster than before, what that means is that you can create more checkpoints in a given period of time. And what that means is that you can recover to a later instant in time, which is what you really need. If your checkpoints are close enough, then recovery is to a much later instant in time or more recent instant in time. So you lose less intelligence or information. So with SOC-TM, the picture changes only about slightly, that the data that's stored in some persistent media, let's say a disk drive, is the absolute bare minimum amount of data that's necessary for recovery, and that in fact allows us to speed up and optimize the checkpoint creation time. Now, to answer Karthik's question, we started with this simple recovery primitive, and to support the recovery primitive, we envisioned the abstraction of a container, and a container is a store, a virtualized store for all the persistent data that the application may wish to create. And these containers can be multiple in nature, and there could be multiple applications that create multiple containers and put relatively independent or even completely independent persistent data within each container. And then the application could go ahead and independently checkpoint containers. Now, from a development standpoint, how do applications use these containers to map those to the persistent portions of their data that they need to do? The applications would create a container or more than one container and create references or pointers for that container to data or data structures that the program uses. And so far, we are thinking from a relatively low-level programming standpoint. We are writing programs in C or C++. This is what the abstraction would look like. Going on to higher-level languages or even further, more primitive languages like Fortran is something that we plan to do in the future. And then all data reachable from the root, because the root has pointers to all these data structures that need to be persistent, all data reachable from the root is discovered, and that discovery process is a process of creating or computing a transitive memory closure set starting from the root of the container, and then restoring just returns back a pointer to the root structure of the container. And you can imagine that given the pointer to the root structure, the application on recovery can access all the data structures within the root, assuming that the application knows the signature of the root structure, which makes sense because the application created the root structure, and then all the data structures within that are reachable from the root. Now, for answering Karthik's question, a variant of the simple container that we also envisioned is the version container, where each checkpoint creates a different version of the container, and the application can recover a container, and in case it finds that data is corrupt, it can go back to a previous version and recover from that version instead.
But how would it find that the data is corrupt? I mean, you have to have some checking mechanism.
Right.
To describe some rules and variables.
I think that's a great question, and in fact, data corruption is something that people are researching now. Data corruption, all the way from the path of writing a memory location to getting stored in some sector on some disk, right? That entire path is fraught with possibilities for corruption, right? And there are people who are working on that independently. We could borrow some of the solutions here by, let's say, creating checksums of data that we write out that doesn't address corruptions in memory, but then other people are addressing memory corruption. So corruption is something that we see as an independent problem that has independent solutions. So let me illustrate this with an example of using a simple container for making a linked list persistent. So here's a volatile linked list written in C. And you can see that there are three nodes or elements of the linked list. And to create the linked list, you go about writing this piece of code, and that creates the linked list for you. Now, the challenge is that if this linked list were required to be persistent, think about the changes that would be necessary to make this linked list persistent. And our goal is to simplify the process of making this linked list persistent. Now, a linked list is a simple data structure, but you could envision really complex data structures and a whole bunch of different data structures and nested data structures, and then the problem becomes even more difficult. So to illustrate how the developer of that linked list or persistent linked list would use a container, there is a simple piece of code that does that. The first thing that the developer would need to do is to create a root structure, which is all the way up there, and create a pointer to the head of the linked list. And then you can ignore the first line of code there because that's during recovery. But during the first execution, the developer would create the container and get a container descriptor and then go about creating the linked list. The only additional operation that the developer would need to do is to create a reference from the container root structure into the head of the linked list. And that's it. And he goes about creating the linked list and modifying the linked list as before. He doesn't need to do anything more than this to ensure that the linked list is persistent. The only additional thing, of course, which we require is that the developer specifies when in execution to make the linked list persistent by creating by showing what we call as a persistence point operation with referencing the specific container that needs to be written. So on the right-hand side, what you're seeing is the in-memory state of the process, which the relevant pages of the in-memory state of the process, these are operating system pages. What we do is to write out the pages of memory as they are to the storage, with some caveats which I'll go into later on. And on the recovery stage, well, the other piece of information that we are storing here is certain metadata which identifies all the locations within each page that contain pointers. And the reason we do that will be clear in just a bit. Upon restore operation, all the developer needs to do is to invoke this one call to restore and immediately gets back the container and memory, as it were before the crash. So in the background, of course, SOC-PM does a whole bunch of different things. The first thing it does is that it reads in the pages of memory that were written out during the checkpointing operation. But then there are certain problems with this. The container is not ready to be used right away because the pointers get stale. Because the state of the process on recovery can be very different than the state of the process when the checkpoint got created. The pages can be loaded into different portions of the process address space. The pointers may no longer be valid. So we go about determining what are the correct values of the pointers in this reincarnation of the process, fix those pointers in each page, and then finally return control to the program. Yes.
So do you assume that the manipulation of the linked list is done in a tight-safe manner? Like, could I copy the linked list pointer to void start and then begin, for example, the program? Like in a WLC program, you don't have restrictions.
Right. So if your program works with volatile linked lists, then it should work with the persistent version of the linked list. We don't make any assumptions about how you infer type of your data.
But if you can change the type of the if you can copy it to a different data type, then you need to track in your tape that, so it's not going to be a pointer anymore, but it's going to have a pointer information. So if we just have a regular link from the programming language perspective, but you have to remember it's a pointer.
Right.
So how do you do that?
That's a great question. We actually don't deal with that right now. In fact, if a program copies a pointer value and stores it with an integer, we don't know that there is a pointer that's stored within an integer. These are some of the restrictions that a developer would have to follow to use our solution, that you cannot store pointer values within integers. Because
so
we cannot then...
Type safe, right? I mean, whatever manipulations you make with the linked list, that should be type safe.
True. But, I can talk about this offline. There are some caveats there. So, a high-level architectural view of our solution is that we eventually want to support three capabilities. Recoverability is what I've been talking about mostly, which is recovering the execution of a program. Then record replay uses version containers to replay all the in-memory, intermediate in-memory states of an application. You can think about many uses of this capability. Say you're doing a simulation and the simulation has multiple stages and later on you want to visualize what happened, you could actually step through the versions of the container that gets modified as the simulation runs. So a record replay capability is quite useful. Execution branching is something that allows cloning of containers and simultaneous processing of copies of containers in an independent fashion. So we envision and have been thinking even from a design standpoint as to what kind of things would need to be ensured to create those capabilities, additional capabilities, but I won't be talking about them today. Now, what I would be talking about most of the time is the first component, which is the LEMA component, which expands to location-independent memory allocator, which is the bulk of the technical work that we have to do to make all this happen. And then a second component, a storage I/O driver component, which I probably won't have time to go into. What we envision in the storage I/O driver component very briefly is that there are some optimizations for performance because you're using specific backends, persistent storage mechanisms, and how you write data to different backends can create very different performance characteristics. So we want to manage that very carefully. The other is to manage atomic checkpoints. Some transaction capability to write to storage is also implemented. Probably won't have time to go into that.
Can I ask a very silly question?
Sure.
You're developing a checkpointing solution which requires considerable knowledge of what is being stored, who's setting the checkpoints, and the data structures. So if I reflect on the whole problem, I could alternatively propose exactly the same solution using simple read-write registers, where all I need to care about is if the linear accessibility property is maintained for whatever fault model you may have. Would that be a very similar approach, or what's
I'm wondering how read-write registers would provide persistence towards power crash, power failures, and software crashes and hardware failures. I don't know enough about read-write registers to answer that question. Okay. So, how persistent memory inside the container is managed by our software is in the form of a multi-level page table as a process's virtual address space is managed within the operating system. It's pretty much the same, except that at the lowest leaf entries, we instead use a slab allocator for making allocations that are persistent. So what you see here is a mechanism to allow addressing all the persistent memory that a program may actually refer to. And this hierarchy does not include any volatile part of the process address space at all. So all of this addresses just the persistent portions of the process address space. Now, in terms of the LEMA component, there are a few operations that are critical that I'll highlight just briefly. When a container gets allocated, the first thing that our system does is to initialize some container metadata, which includes things like the pointer list and this multi-level page table. And in the container restoration step, the system loads the container data, fixes the pointers, and returns the root to the container structure. So these are the high-level steps that allocation and restoration involve.
Prashu?
Yes.
You have about 15 minutes.
Thanks. So in the container discovery process, what our system does at a very high level is that it recursively follows pointers starting from the container root and creates a persistent memory closure, a transitive closure. So we deal with things like loops and so on because we keep track of what we visited already. And finally, there's a memory reorganization step because the discovery can discover portions of the volatile part of the address space. Then we copy chunks of allocations from the volatile portions into the persistent portions, which are then indexed using the multi-level container page table. So memory allocation for the persistent version of all allocations are managed by SOCPM. And then the memory pages are either classified as being volatile or persistent. So because of this capability, we are able to choose to write only the pages that contain persistent data. There is one complication here when we move data or we copy data, in fact we move data in this case, from volatile portions to the persistent portions, back references that may point to such data would need to be fixed up to make the entire state of memory consistent. So I'll illustrate the problem of and the solution of discovering data very briefly. And yes.
How do you remove the data from the water to restrict them far?
Yes.
That you could do this
atomically? We do it atomically because we actually block the application.
But you could actually have a primary instead of
Well, when we do the move, that's from volatile memory to volatile and not to the persistent storage. It's the persistent indexed part of the volatile memory that we are moving it into. So we don't touch the persistent part of the container which is in storage, which is the only part that is going to be preserved after a power failure. So if we lose that, it's perfectly fine because it's still volatile memory. We just mark it as persistent so that we can write it out to persistent storage eventually. So we divide memory, as I said before, into two regions, volatile and persistent. And then we have this issue of four kinds of pointers that go back and forth from either type of memory and within the same type as well. So pointers within the same type of memory are okay, and we don't really have to worry about them. But pointers that cross the boundary are the ones that are important when we do discovery discovery and reorganization operations. Now, how we discover and reorganize is illustrated by the simple chart. Reference to the structure that a program may wish to make persistent are embedded in the container root structure specified by the programmer. Now, interestingly, you can see that there is no real restriction as to point to some intermediate portion of a linked list, right? So that flexibility is afforded with this sort of a model. So what we do when the discovery process is begun is that we walk through all the pointers in the root structure, and then create a copy of the target location. So we need to know about all pointers as well as all locations, all allocate memory allocations and the sizes of those allocations, so we could go about creating a copy of the appropriate size. And then we recursively do the same thing for the set of pointers in this new allocation. Now we free the previous. Now, of course, you see a problem with the dangling pointer starting from B4, and we'll deal with that in just a bit. But once we go through this process of recursively traversing pointers, all the data that needs to be persistent is now persistent. The only other thing that we need to do now is to fix the back references, and we can do that because we know the location of all volatile as well as persistent pointers. And if memory gets moved, we can go ahead and fix those pointers. So then the developer responsibility in a nutshell is to allocate the containers, assign root structures to containers, make root structures point to data, and when I say data, I mean just the, let's say, the entry point of a data structure, and invoke persistence point creation operations. So we think that this is a fairly easy model for developers to adopt.
So if I accidentally, as a developer, introduce a pointer from persistent to volatile memory, you could in effect be copying an entire data structure from volatile memory to persistent.
Yeah, that's a great point. And in the API, we have an exclude primitive. So the developer, if he knows that there is a pointer that's useful but doesn't need to be made persistent, or the target doesn't need to be made persistent, then he can explicitly exclude that reference. But if it's an accidental problem, then one of the things that we can do with a tool like this is to show or visualize the closure. And then he can actually see what parts of the closure may be accidentally included and go ahead and do the exclude references.
So this is wondering why you chose to allow this rather than use a static type system to disallow all these.
I think we wanted to primarily deal with system software, which is written in C. And C is a weakly typed language. That's the primary reason for that. Yes?
Yeah. If I understand correctly what you're doing, you're trying to not modify too much the original C program.
Or alternatively, to introduce for new programs in a very minimal way persistent memory capability.
So my question would be, have you looked to approaches to automatically transform existing programs? So the other solution would be not to have a complex runtime system that tries to evolve the program at the system.
We haven't looked at that possibility, but that sounds very interesting. I can think of a lot of challenges in going in that direction, but I would love to talk to you about that. Yes.
Alternatively, there was a piece talked about what's called computer programming and all people use
that.
It's still very similar.
I think there are similarities and then there are quite a few differences as well. And I think we can have a really long discussion about that. But yeah, you're absolutely right. People have actually. Right. And since then, I think the programming languages have evolved in nature, and the kinds of system software that we're dealing with today is different than the kinds of system software we were dealing with at that time. Maybe Grasshopper was well ahead of its time. I mean, that's one possible answer that I can give you. But they don't do things in the way that we do, which we believe simplifies it even further, simplifies the programming model even further. So, actually, I'm going to go over this really quickly and probably jump through a few slides and go into some evaluation that we did with our system. So pointer detection in SOC-PM is, as you can imagine, is the most critical part, and detecting pointers is a very hard problem. And what we observed is that we can, in fact, this is a tractable problem if we understood how the life cycle of a pointer operates within a program. A pointer first gets allocated, or rather memory for storing the pointer gets allocated, then the value of the pointer gets initialized, the pointer gets used, and eventually the pointer may get deallocated. Of course, some of these are optional steps, right? Could be that the pointer just got allocated and nothing happened, you just, you know, wasted that memory, or you didn't initialize it and use it, that's a bug. So, I mean, we are talking about programs that are correct. So, to detect pointers, we use a two-phase pointer detection process. First is a static analysis phase, where we do a source-to-source translation of the original C program. And then a dynamic analysis phase, where we track at runtime only initialized pointers. Pointers that don't get initialized, we don't care about, and we don't track, because we think that it's meaningless to track uninitialized pointers. Initialization can be both explicit and implicit. And I'll talk about that in just a bit. So to give you an example of what we're doing in the static analysis phase, let's say that we have a node of a linked list, and then the linked list gets used by first allocating memory. As soon as memory gets allocated for the linked list, there are two things that specific instruction, a C code, would result in. First is that we'll record that a malloc occurred at an address L of 5n. So we keep track of all memory allocations. So if there is a custom memory allocation routine, it must be registered with our system. So that's a drawback of our solution. And then the second thing that we do is that we note that there is a pointer at the address of L. And we record that because that pointer value actually got initialized with that step. Now you notice that although eventually the intention is to create a linked list, a node of a linked list, and there is an additional pointer inside that node, we haven't recorded that pointer as a pointer yet, because that pointer is not yet initialized. So initialization can happen in two ways. Explicit initialization by being an L value of an assignment operation, as you see up there. But there's also implicit initialization because of memory moving and memory copying operations. And so because we keep track of all memory copying and memory moving operations as well, we track implicit initializations of pointers and record those. Yes, 5 minutes. All right, so there are some ideas as to how we make containers persistent with high performance in an atomic fashion. And in the interest of time, I'll probably go over those, but I think I've touched on some of the high-level points of the key problems. The ideas here are not entirely novel, so I feel comfortable skipping over them. But I'll be happy to tell you about what we deal, how we allow asynchronous checkpointing, which is that the program issues a checkpoint and it can continue modifying data structures. And we use a copy on write idea to do that. And that's a capability that current solutions do not really allow. And I think that's really critical because that allows simulations to progress faster and self-management systems to become more responsive because they don't have to wait for checkpointing operations to complete. So let me skip over a few slides. Sorry, I didn't mean to skip over that. And tell you a little bit about the evaluation that we did. And we wanted to compare the performance of our solution with other competing solutions that provide application level persistence, or ALP as we call it. So one of the things that we did was implemented a few basic data structures, which we think is a simple case scenario, and looked at the complexity of making those data structures persistent using our solution, as well as manually done by the developer, which is, in fact, in the simulation space is the current state of the art. Every simulation program has its own checkpointing routine written by an independent developer, which is repetitious in our opinion. So we look at the complexity measure using lines of code. For doing a performance evaluation, we use micro benchmarks to create one or more containers. We populated each container with a single type of data structure and vary the size of that data structure. We perform random updates within the data structure and vary the locality of those updates. So if you look at the lines of code, you can see immediately that for complex data structures like hash tables, serializing those data structures can involve substantial development effort and also error prone. So if you make mistakes, then you lose time and money. So on the other hand, with a soft PM kind of solution, you create a container, point to the head of the hash table, and that's it, right? And create checkpoints. So the development effort is very minimal in our opinion. For the performance evaluation, we use a metric called normalized relative time. This is the time related to the application level custom solution that the developer might create, divided by the amount of time that soft PM takes to do certain operations divided by the amount of time it takes to do it in the traditional way. So any value above 1 indicates that our solution is performing worse, and values below 1 indicates that we are actually competitive or better. So on the x-axis you see two clusters of bars. One is for the persist operation and the other is for the restore operation. And I must point out here that there is no incremental change tracking in this experiment, so everything gets written out because the first time operation, same for restore. So what you see here is that there are some gains and some losses when we analyze what happened with the B3 and the list. We found out that the pointer to data ratio in these data structures were very high. So in the B3 case, we had 1 4-byte integer and 2 8-byte 64-bit pointers within each node pointing to the left and right child. And our current solution is, in our opinion, drastically or highly unoptimized. So we see room for improving how we deal with pointers and how much overhead it takes to process pointers and things of that kind in the future. So I'll be happy to talk more about the performance numbers. Let me skip over some additional sensitivity study that we did and talk a little bit about one specific real-world example of using software persistent memory. So which database do you think is the most widely used?
Sorry, you'll be out of time in about 10 seconds.
10 seconds, sorry.
Sorry.
Okay, so we did a case study using SQLite, which does not support a persistent database, and we converted an SQLite in-memory database into a persistent database with very minimal effort. And we think that this is testimony to both the correctness of what we do as well as the utility of what we do. And I'll be happy to talk more about this. So let me stop here and acknowledge the people who are working on this project. There are 4 students, and some of them have left, though, who work on this project. And And I'm also collaborating with some other professors at FIU on this project, on different aspects of this project. So thank you very much, and I'll be happy to take more questions and can also talk offline if there are any questions. Thank you.